You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. New Yorkers can see the homeless on the street, but hunger is often hidden, even though it's more widespread than homelessness. The impact of hunger, especially on children, may make it the greatest threat facing the poor. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 17.6 million households were food insecure at some time in 2012. Here in New York, Joel Berg leads research in hunger, food security, and poverty. He's the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. I'm pleased that he's joining us again to discuss trends in hunger, what is being done, and what could be done. Hi, Joel. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
A term that appears a lot is food insecurity. What does that mean exactly? How is that different from hunger?
It is a horrible, wonkish term I could never even explain to my mother. But it really is the best description of hunger in the American context. It's not people necessarily starving in the streets like North Korea or Somalia. It represents hunger in the American context. People rationing food, choosing between food and rent, choosing between food and health care. Parents going without meals to feed their children, children sometimes having to go through the dumpsters in back of their school to get a meal. So it really describes people balancing food choices, rationing food, not having enough food to get by. I say it describes people living in households that just can't afford enough food.
Does it also involve downgrading the food that you're consuming?
Oh, there's no question that hunger and obesity are actually flip sides of the same malnutrition coin. If you can't afford healthier food, which is often more expensive, if you live in a low-income neighborhood and you can't even find healthier food, there's no question that one of the top coping strategies is to buy less healthy, less expensive food that you can just fill your bellies, fill your kids' bellies, more calories, but it's less healthy. And that's why we have this amazing irony in America. You can be food insecure, you can be hungry, you can be low income, and still be overweight.
How severe a problem is food insecurity in the United States, and how do we stack up against other industrialized countries?
We're last. We're worst.
Okay.
You want more details?
No, tell me. I was afraid of that.
We're the only major industrialized Western society on the planet that has this high level of hunger and this high level of poverty. 49 million of our neighbors live in food insecure households. That includes 16 million American children. Here in New York City, 1.4 million New Yorkers, one out of six New Yorkers and one out of five children live in homes that can't afford enough food. And this is a country where there are so many billionaires. Merely having only $1 billion doesn't get you on the Forbes 400 list anymore. So it really is incredible, even though we don't have mass Somalia-type starvation anymore, that we do have such mass deprivation, and that has hugely detrimental effects on our health, on our economy. And I must say, sometimes people on the right say, well, you've just admitted it's not as bad as Somalia. What are you complaining about?
Well, that's going to be the bar that we're setting.
Well, that's what people say. Well, we don't compare our Olympic teams to Somalia or North Korea. We don't compare our space program to them. It's a ridiculously low bar. And the other thing the right doesn't admit, the only reason we don't have mass third world style starvation is because of the very nutrition assistance programs they hate and demonize. The SNAP program, formerly the food stamps program, is what keeps us from having mass famine and starvation.
Well, you mentioned the SNAP program. SNAP refers to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. But Congress just reduced the benefits of this program in November. Isn't that right?
Congress and the President of the United States reduced the benefits as part of a deal cut in 2010 to improve the quality of school meals. Republicans insisted on cuts in SNAP benefits. And unfortunately, the Democrats went along and they said, oh, we'll fix it later. Some of us pointed out when it comes to low-income people, later never comes. Later was this November 1st, and every one of the 47 million Americans who rely on these benefits to feed themselves and their children faced a cut. Now, the average is $30 a month, but averages are very deceptive. If you average my salary with Bill Gates, I'm a billionaire. And so some people had far higher cuts. I met a woman in New York City, putting two kids through, raising two kids while putting herself through college, she lost $45 a month. And before the cuts, the average benefit would run out in 2 to 3 weeks. And so people are really struggling. On top of that, in addition to that, Congress just cut the food stamp SNAP program by an additional $8.7 billion. So, you know, in America, we're socialized into thinking there's always going to be some sort of Frank Capra-esque happy ending. You know, the banker's, mean old banker's going to have a change of heart in the end, or everyone in the town's going to pool in their money and do a food drive, and everything's going to be okay. That's not what happens in the real world. What happens in the real world is low-income people suffer more, and that's what you're seeing in New York and communities all across the country.
And aren't SNAP benefits underused by those who are eligible for them? Anyway?
Yes. Well, you'd never know that from the right-wing media. For me, the biggest scandal isn't that 1.2% of food stamps recipients traffic in the program, the lowest rate of fraud in history in the program, lower rate of fraud than most other walks of American society. In fact, 2% of the House of Representatives pled guilty to crimes or went to prison over the last decade. So there's nearly twice as much fraud in Congress as there is in the food stamps program. But people seem obsessed by that 1.2%. In any case, a far bigger problem is that tens of millions of Americans, working people, people with disabilities, veterans, families with children, senior citizens are eligible for these benefits. And because we have demonized them as a society so much that they just don't apply, or we create this series of barriers to application, basically treating people like criminals because they have the bad luck of temporarily being poor.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org, and I am speaking to Joel Berg. He is executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and we are talking about the problem of food insecurity. Now, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, New York City has the largest homeless population in the country. How does New York compare with regard to food insecurity in terms of are stacking up against other cities?
Well, we don't know precisely because we don't measure at that level, at the federal level, but we do know that we have a far higher level here than any of our world competitors. There's certainly far more hunger here than in Paris or London or Tokyo because the United States just has such a high level. Look, when people consider the homeless population, they stereotypically think of the person on the street who is panhandling, when in fact that is a small subsection of who's homeless. And the people who are homeless are a small subsection of who's hungry. Here in New York City, about 50,000 people are going to sleep in homeless shelters tonight, and about 1.4 million people live in households that can't afford enough food. Now, our poverty rate is slightly lower than some other big cities like Detroit or Philadelphia, and so the previous mayor would basically go on a victory tour saying, oh, we're better than Detroit, we're better than Philadelphia, totally ignoring the last 100 years of history and saying we're doing great. I don't think we're doing great if we're considered against the world's fantastic cities that you always think of as world capitals. And again, we're the only country like ours with this level of poverty and hunger, and we're the only city like ours, a big, major world capital in a Western, developed, wealthy country that has this problem. New York City alone has 53 billionaires. Their net worth has skyrocketed over the last few years. They now have a net worth of about $180 billion. Now, I'm a committed capitalist. I really am. My grandparents came here and built a better life for themselves and their grandchildren and their children through hard work and determination through opportunity capitalism. But those 53 billionaires in New York City now have a net worth of $180 billion. Most people, your listeners, probably have no clue what that is. It's more than they have in their pocket. The city budget of the city of New York is roughly $60 billion. So that means, in plain English, that the 53 wealthiest New Yorkers have about three times as much money as everything the city spends on schools, parks, police officers, firefighters, public health, safe drinking water, everything. Something is seriously wrong when we have that concentration of wealth, when opportunity capitalism is no longer working, when it's been replaced by crony capitalism, and 1.4 million people in this city don't earn enough to feed their families.
Now, speaking of the city government, critics have charged that the government counts numbers of homeless on the streets in the winter because the cold forces people off the street and that lowers the numbers. Is that true? And does the city also undercount the number of people going hungry?
In the previous administration, the Bloomberg administration, there was a concerted attempt over a long period of time to find every possible way to minimize the problem. Mayor Bloomberg actually claimed that people were purposely faking being homeless, essentially, so they could live in these wonderful Taj Mahal homeless shelters. It sounds like one of your made-up joke tweets or April Fool's joke. It's actually true. And to some degree, they had the belief that people really weren't hungry or homeless, that maybe it was a handful of substance abusers on the street. So the federal data that's used by the city systematically undercounts the problem. It uses census data. So if there are people who don't want to be counted, they're not counted. Often homeless people are not counted in the hunger statistics. So the numbers are probably more than the 1.4 million the federal statistics state. However, I know the new mayor just a bit, and I've gotten to work a little with some of the people who work for him, and I'm confident that they have an entirely different attitude, that they believe to solve the problem, you have to admit the problem and deal with it. And they are certainly doing that in their first few months. I know lots of elites in New York City are going crazy that the man's keeping his campaign promises, and they're going nuts that he's actually meeting the needs of the vast majority of New Yorkers instead of catering to them. But he is doing what the people elected him to do. And one of the things they elected him to do was reduce poverty, reduce inequality. And they are committed, to my understanding, of being frank about the levels of this problem in order to address it.
What difference between de Blasio and Bloomberg was that Bloomberg opposed increasing taxes on the wealthy, and Mayor de Blasio campaigned in part on a promise to do what Bloomberg would not do. How likely do you think we are to see an increase in taxes on the wealthy?
And be clear that Mayor Bloomberg evolved on this. His first budget proposed tax increases, supposedly because we had this disaster after 9/11. We obviously had a huge disaster after 9/11, but we had fiscal disasters for years that followed and still need the money. And even Bloomberg admitted that wealthy people do not make their decisions on where to live based on the tax rates. But if Donald Trump's listening, and you're particularly worried that if somehow de Blasio wins and he's able to raise taxes in New York City to the level that he proposed, basically increasing by one latte's worth of purchases a day your taxes. And if you really can't afford to live in New York City, I will buy your bus ticket to Dubuque. So I don't know whether it's going to happen. We know what works, and we're doing the opposite. There's no question the wealthiest in the society are undertaxed. In the Eisenhower administration, the wealthiest paid 94% of their income in taxes. Now the federal tax rate is 39.6%. And that doesn't even kick in till $200,000, because the recent tax deal in Washington concluded, boy, if you're only making, it doesn't kick in till $400,000. So if you're making $380,000, the national political debate still says you're middle class, even though you're making nearly eight times the average family.
I'm speaking with Joel Berg, executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. We're talking about poverty and food insecurity for this week's installment of our Strapped series. And we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. How many New Yorkers are hungry? How many New Yorkers don't have enough to eat or the right kinds of food to eat, can't afford it? Well, today's guest is shedding some light on that. He is Joel Berg. He's the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, and he is also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Now, Joel, the Food Bank for New York City reports that almost one-third of city residents, quote, reported difficulty affording needed food in 2012. That was down from 2011. But how does that compare with figures in better economic times? Are we still dealing with a great deal of distress?
Yeah, essentially, for low-income Americans, there's been no real meaningful economic recovery since the Great Recession of 2008. The job numbers still horrible, particularly if you include people who've just given up and stopped looking for work. If you look at the so-called labor force statistics, not to get too wonky with your listeners, but that's basically the people who are actually working as opposed to the people reporting who they're looking for work. You'll see that in many low-income neighborhoods, the percentage of people in the workforce workforce is still very slow. And despite what Paul Ryan says, it's not because they're not interested in working. It's because the jobs that don't exist. Wages are still very, very meager, haven't kept up with inflation, particularly when you compare it to the cost of rent and housing. And so there may be recovery for the people on the very top, but there's no recovery for the vast majority of working New Yorkers and Americans. And that's essentially why hunger is still such a problem, because people just don't earn enough to feed their families. Everyone wants to make this big, complicated mystery. If you earn less than your rent is, you don't have money left over for food, period.
Now, the report says that people reported difficulty. Does that mean that the food bank or others are relying on people self-reporting? How reliable is that approach?
There are different ways of counting these numbers. If people are asked to say, do you have difficulty, they're going to come up with a higher number than the federal number of 1.4 million of people actually lacking food. I will say, when the right attacked the USDA methodology and basically said, you're just asking people how they feel about their food, USDA, where I previously worked, went through a complicated series of projects to study the actual food consumption of low-income people, and they found to track very closely to their food insecurity methodology. And, you know, for all the deniers out there, non-believers in this data, I know there are people who don't believe in evolution or gravity or other theories, that they can join me in visiting a soup kitchen or a food pantry in New York City to see for themselves. These are often run by people of faith. When John Boehner came to town last week to do a fundraiser, we did invite him to visit a soup kitchen or food pantry with us. People will be shocked to know he did not take us up on the invitation, but he or anyone who doubts this is a serious problem should just go to one of these agencies and see the people line up for hours in advance just to get a few days' worth of food for their families.
You mentioned Paul Ryan. Wasn't there a Paul Ryan photo op during the 2012 campaign where he showed up at a soup kitchen and pretended to wash some dishes or something like that?
Yes, he did do that. The truth of the matter, though, is it represents the broader problem that most people who volunteer to fight hunger just showing up at a soup kitchen or food pantry around the holidays aren't really reducing the problem. I know I'm a horrible curmudgeon, but the truth is most people are merely displacing an eighth grader who was there the day before. If you really want to end hunger in America, you need to join with groups like the New York City Coalition Against Hunger to fight for living wage jobs, to fight for an adequate safety net, to ensure that eligible families get the nutrition assistance they deserve, and that's what's going to end this problem in America. So, yes, he was particularly crass about it, Paul Ryan, and it was particularly ironic. Here's a guy that keeps cutting hunger funding, going and showing up at a pantry and kitchen. And the greatest thing is when he says he's going to reduce hunger and poverty by taking away hunger and poverty funding. My response is that's like saying you're going to reduce drought by taking away water. It's thoroughly disingenuous. And understand, this is a calculated political strategy. Before Reagan was elected, people like Barry Goldwater would admit publicly that, you know what, we know if you do these things, poverty and hunger may increase, but that's okay because they're lazy bums. They don't really deserve it. And they kept getting clobbered in the polls. So they had these pollsters for the Republicans and the conservatives, which came up with this new line. Oh, we're going to liberate people. We're going to help them by taking away their food and health care. And somehow the American people in too many places have bought that. It's a thoroughly disingenuous message. I'd have at least some grudging respect for them if they were honest and saying, yeah, we are taking away food and money from poor people. And that's that.
Well, that's the whole Frank Luntz thing of like put a new twist on it that makes it sound like you're doing something positive. We're liberating them from food. Representative Paul Ryan also claimed, and this is somewhat Reagan-esque, that he heard a report about a young boy from a very poor family who would get a free lunch from a government program. And he said he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch, one in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. Is this just something that was made up in some?
It was as absolutely 1,000% fabricated. Mm-hmm. He heard someone who heard someone who overheard someone, and the original story was absolutely the opposite about how a kid benefited from school lunch. But, you know, this has policy implications, too. Jack Kingston, a senior Republican congressperson from Georgia, who's a leading candidate for U.S. Senate there, actually proposed seriously requiring young people in school to work to sweep the floors in the school in exchange for school meals. So we do an April Fool's press release every year. I know, Andy, you'll be shocked to know that some people create fake news for a cheap laugh.
That's terrible.
But we had our headline this year is House GOP calls for work requirement for WIC infants. And then I said, but why wait till the kid's born? Why not put treadmills in the womb for the kids? The Republicans called for that in my joke. And it's amazing how many people wrote to me not sure whether it was a joke or not.
A little too close.
Yeah.
A little too close for comfort. Now, over 9 million people die worldwide each year from hunger and malnutrition. Is anyone actually dying from hunger or malnutrition in the United States, or are we just suffering health consequences and other consequences?
We do not have mass numbers of adults dropping dead in the streets because of hunger. We certainly have one of the highest rates of infant mortality in the developed world because of hunger. And the Women's Infants and Children Program, the WIC program, which the sequestration pushed by Republicans cut, has saved 500,000 babies from dying at birth. So I can't help but note the irony is that people who claim to be pro-life voted to cut a program which has prevented 500,000 babies from dying. And there's no question people die earlier because of this in the United States. Hunger in America, food insecurity in America, costs our society $167.5 billion a year, according to a study by the Center for American Progress, because hungry children don't learn. Hungry workers don't work. Hungry seniors don't stay independent. And I've calculated we could end hunger entirely in America for about $35 billion of food purchasing power for low-income people. So it seems crazy if we can end a problem for $35 billion that costs our society $167 billion a year.
And what are some of the health problems that come from this problem of food insecurity and malnutrition?
No question that poor nutrition compromises immune systems, makes it more likely for children, adults, and seniors to stay healthy. There's no question it reduces attention in school. There's no question that there's serious problems with diabetes. A new study came out that emergency room intakes for diabetes-related illnesses and diabetes itself peak near the end of the month. And there was strong indication from that research it's because food stamps benefits, SNAP benefits, run out near the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So again, even though we're marginally better off than some of the poorest countries in the world because we have some safety net, this is killing our country in very serious ways.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm talking to Joel Berg. He is the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And we are talking about food insecurity. In 2012, Bloomberg barred food donations to homeless shelters on grounds that the city couldn't assess the nutritional value of the food donations. And two Democrats on the LA City Council proposed banning charities and individuals from giving food to the homeless in public. Are proposals like this widespread?
They are, although the Bloomberg action is not the same as the LA action banning food distribution. And this is one of the rare times I actually defended Mayor Bloomberg.
Okay.
It was kind of a bogus story. It was not something imposed on all shelters due to his new nutrition standards. There are serious food safety issues, and this is a long-standing policy, and you can still donate food to private shelters throughout New York City. This was just city-run shelters. It was a fascinating sort of case study of sort of how this stuff gets relayed in the media and the social media. Conservatives loved the story because it reinforced their view that Bloomberg was this horrible nanny state liberal, and liberals loved it because it reinforced their storyline that it was this horrible, out-of-touch plutocrat. It wasn't really a fair attack on Bloomberg. But the truth is what LA is doing and municipalities around the country are doing are trying to criminalize feeding homeless people. And that is absolutely appalling, just as many cities basically make it criminal to be homeless.
And on what basis are they doing that, though? They have to have a rationale that they put forth. So what is that rationale?
Badges? We don't need your stinking badges. I mean, they basically make up rationales. They have loitering laws. They claim it's a public order, a food safety issue. It really is the ostrich approach to a public policy. And somehow, if you think criminalizing homelessness is going to solve the problem, you're pretty out of it. But unfortunately, that's how many public policy people think. I live on the edge of Park Slope in Prospect Heights, a fabulously self-consciously liberal area. And about a decade ago, a homeless shelter, small homeless shelter, was coming into Prospect Heights for women and children. The liberals in my neighborhood went berserk. So it's always easy to say, oh, those yahoos in other places. But we ought to look a little closer to home about our attitudes here.
And what were their rationales at the time?
It was going to ruin the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There was going to be a crime wave. There were some flyers they were handing out with concentric circles, with the center being the homeless shelter, like it was a map of a blast chart.
Right.
It used to be an anti-nuclear activist, like where you'd say, here's Indian Point and here's where you'll get radiated. And it was almost that serious. Now, the great irony of the world is, the greatest irony is that the homeless shelter went in. It was fine. It didn't change the neighborhood at all. Property values continued to skyrocket. And a few years ago, that homeless shelter was torn down to make way for a parking lot for the Barclay Center.
Wonderful. Now, you've been taking a lot of whacks today at the right wing and people like Paul Ryan.
I can make fun of liberals now.
Well, yeah, I wanted to shift gears.
Yes.
Because you've noted that President Obama pledged during his 2008 campaign to end childhood hunger by 2015. How much progress has been made toward that? I think I know the answer.
We've gone backwards. And unfortunately, our political system now is a stark divide between evil versus spineless. And so the spineless side, they theoretically support the stuff, except they sign it into law. President Obama made a stirring speech about why food stamps cuts were a horrible thing for the country at the ceremony at which he signed them into law. So it's my job as an advocate not to be a toady for anyone. Now, I'm not going to engage in false equivalency. There is one side that is systematically trying to undercut the nutrition assistance safety net. There's one side that's using race baiting, that's systematically trying to mischaracterize low-income people's lives. On the other hand, the other side that's supposed to stand up for justice really needs to go to France to get a backbone infusion. And so it really is a sad state. And we need a new poor people's movement of low-income people engaged and people in the middle to pressure our elected officials to do the right thing. A few decades ago, gay rights was the losing side of the American political equation. And gay activists banded it together and said, we're not going to accept being labeled half-human, having the laws call us half-human. And hunger advocates all need to have more of a little stiff backbone as well and have the guts to hold our elected officials accountable no matter what the party and not accept from people who sort of kind of agree with us, oh, we were forced into cutting food for hungry people because the other side was so bad. The cuts the Democrats just agreed to in the Farm Bill are 8 times the cuts President George W. Bush proposed, and they adamantly opposed at the time. You know, most of my positions, I work for a think tank in Washington, D.C. in 1989, the Progressive Policy Institute, which were so-called moderate Democrats affiliated with the Democratic Leadership Council. People thought I was a conservative or a moderate then. I hold the same views I have today. I believe in the centrality of work. I believe that work should pay. I believe we need a basic safety net that promotes work but's there for people when they're down on the luck. What's a mainstream position, a position basically I'd agree with Bob Dole on most things, who is, you know, a right-wing Republican who supported food stamps. The fact that they're now characterized as sort of left-wing is ridiculous to me and shows you how far our political system has moved to the loony right to basically assuage a handful of people who don't even come close to representing the majority in their own party, no less the country.
Well, you're looking for political solutions. The poor actually vote in far lower percentages than wealthier Americans do. Do you have any suggestions on how to boost voting in poor communities?
Yes, and Charles Blow had a great column a few days ago, basically that people should rise up and vote. The truth of the matter is all campaign spending in the world doesn't buy votes in most cases. It buys the ability to influence voters. And if voters remain uninfluenced, if they get educated, they get engaged, they can really change things. The truth of the matter is the wealthiest candidate doesn't always win. And the only people that upset me more than conservatives are apolitical people who just don't vote. You claim that by not voting, you're sending a message that you really have distaste for the political system. No. You're sending the message that you don't care enough to take 5 minutes and cross the street when people around the globe are getting their heads cracked open for trying to vote. It is a cop-out, and we ought to stop blaming them and start looking a little closer at us. It's not me, it's not you, it's me. And the me is the American people, and all people have to stop whining that we can't change our political system and get in the system. By the time he was 23, my father, who was not particularly a robust man physically, volunteered for World War II. If he could have done that, the least people can do is vote, learn how their elected officials are acting, pick up a phone and call them. We can change the system. It worked once. In the late 1960s, the Poor People's Campaign, started by Dr. King, pressured the American government to dramatically reduce poverty in America. People think the war on poverty was a failure, but between 1960 and 1974, the poverty rate in America was cut in half. We can do it again, but we need to get off our duffs. And people need to support groups like the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. Plug, plug, plug. After you give all your money to the NYC pledge drive, give your rest to us, that we need to support groups that aren't just saying a food drive is going to solve the problem, but we need to deal with the systematic, long-term, effective solutions.
Okay, so they can go online and find your organization, and they can do what? They can contribute money.
They can contribute money. They can volunteer. We also have a website, hungervolunteer.org, that's trying to redefine hunger volunteerism, to say that if you are an accountant, 5 hours of accounting help for a small pantry or kitchen would do more than 5 months of serving a soup. And we also want to engage people in public policy advocacy. The cuts that were just implemented in the Farm Bill dwarf all the work of every soup kitchen, food pantry, food bank in America. We need to do something differently.
Excellent. I've been talking with Joel Berg, Executive Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. We've been talking about poverty and food insecurity for this week's installment of our STRAP series. You can find out more about our STRAP series on our show page. Joel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.